This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. Kernisha Whiteside is passionate about art, and as a curator, she showcases the works of fellow artists. A Chattanooga native, she is now the chief curator at AVA, the Association of Visual Arts. Tomorrow, starting at 11 a.m., Kernisha will appear at the Chattery as part of its new monthly Coffee Talk series, sharing her perspective as a Black woman in the art world with a dialogue open to all about diversity in the creative field. Kernisha, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
How did you get into curating?
I went to Center for Creative Arts from 6th through 12th grade, so being an artist myself and growing up around emerging artists, I never wanted to leave that environment. Opening up my own museum is the ultimate goal, but curating, because I learned, you know, you have to have a certain amount of money to open up your own museum. So curating was an introduction to museum work and how I could get the gist of what a museum is made of, and it really fits into my personality. So once I learned what it was, I fell in love with it, and it fits me.
And your work has taken you to Nashville. It's taken
it
you
has.
To Augusta, Georgia.
Yes. It's it has, now that I think about it, it's taken me a lot of places. But yeah, curating exhibitions and then just interning under other curators, like at the Frist Museum and working at the Hunter Museum for a little bit, and then now AVA. It's taken me a lot of different places.
And beyond the Southeast, New York City comes to mind.
Yeah.
I know you're making plans for LA and for Italy.
Yes. So working, for example, Genesis the Great Kid, he's one of the artists who I curate his exhibitions, and he travels a lot. So whenever he goes to Detroit or New York, I'll go with him, and then we collaborate on a project. We recently curated his show here in October, and he does collaboration pieces with Audrey Schultz. And Audrey Schultz, she's so sweet, and she's one of the backbones to the Ralph Lauren brand. She's, especially with the women's line, she helped create the look of Ralph. They collaborate on some pieces, so I've curated her work. So when we go to New York, we're meeting up with her in Hamptons and hanging out and just talking art. So yeah, a lot of travel comes in this career.
Tell us more about your coffee talk coming up at the Chattery.
Yeah, so the Chattery, they are wanting to bring in professionals in different careers and just sit down and have like a roundtable discussion with whoever is interested. They wanted to talk about something that dealt with diversity, and they came to me, and we were just talking about the arts and arts professionals, and they were like, well, what class can you lead? And I said, well, being an African-American female working in the art world, it's very rare to see another one of me in a room, especially in the South. So this coffee talk will hit on that topic and really talk about the variety of cultures in a world that is living off of culture. It's like the art is a representation of what's happening in the culture. So the coffee talk will really talk about that. And then I'll share my experiences as being a Black woman in the arts. But I really want it to be an open conversation and just see what other people think about it and see how other people are experiencing it in the city. So I'm really excited to hear what people have to say.
A Black woman in the arts who grew up here in Chattanooga.
Right, right. I don't know any other Black curators in the South. So since I've been doing research, getting ready for the coffee talk, it's really interesting to see the numbers.
You are involved with emerging artists, working artists. Tell me how that's informed your perspective.
I have a soft spot for emerging artists because they're so hungry and they're like sponges. They're just ready and eager. They don't really have boundaries because they don't know what the rules are yet. Working artists, they're kind of in this position where they're adults, so they have reality that they have to deal with on top of trying to stay stuck in this creative realm. It's an interesting dynamic. So I see a lot more diversity in emerging artists than professional artists because people of color don't really have those resources to be able to sustain as much as their counterparts are as far as like professional artists. So just witnessing that in itself, especially in Chattanooga, going back to AVA, we really don't have a strong number as far as artists of color. And I don't think that's a coincidence. I think it's just our society and, you know, the system, and it's a chain reaction.
And this is where we get into the difference between expectations and reality, and the data telling the tale between the two.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
Also, the difference between how a perspective that you're sharing applies in a for-profit business mm-hmm. versus a nonprofit business.
Yeah, yeah. Nonprofit businesses have a lot more red tape, but they also get a lot more support because you have these foundations that support nonprofits, and you're not really seeking for patrons as much as you are with for-profit businesses. So I represent an artist out in California who's actually from Germany and stayed in Chattanooga for a bit, but now in California. And I'm working with her and putting her artwork in businesses and trying to get patrons for her. And it's a completely different ordeal than just curating artwork in a nonprofit gallery because I don't have the pressure of trying to sell. Museums and galleries in general, their main objective is to either educate or exhibit a certain genre of art or specific ethnic group of artists, or like they have a main objective, but selling artwork isn't it. So working in the for-profit realm, acquiring patrons and just really representing artists, it's a completely different mindset that I have to switch depending on what I'm doing.
Circling back to what you were talking about earlier, mm-hmm. as a Black woman in the arts who grew up here in Chattanooga, what perspective do you want to get across to people that they may not know, or that they may think they know, but they don't know enough?
Diversity is key, especially, and I'll be covering this on Saturday, the different positions, specifically in a museum, some of those positions require different backgrounds, just so you're more well-rounded and more aware of how you're presenting work and information to a mass group of people. Me and my executive director at AVA, she's a older white mother. I'm a young Black female with no kids. So we'll have different ideas, but she'll tell me something that I never even thought of, and then vice versa. And having those corrected moments is what makes our mission thrive even better, because we're able to execute better and we're able to make sure we don't make mistakes as far as representation or just saying something that may not be offensive to one group but may be offensive to another. So I think that's important, that people realize that the more diverse, the better, the stronger it is.
This conversation takes place at a time where Chattanooga is growing mm-hmm. and changing, but yeah. also plenty of concerns mm-hmm. about what that growth and change can also bring.
Yeah, yeah. I think the entire country is at this very sensitive point where everything has to be double-checked, triple-checked, because we're so sensitive as far as how we approach each other and how we label each other, and we have to be more careful.
Or as some people would say in another context, more mindful.
Yeah, yeah.
What inspires you to do what you do?
Oh, the art. There's so much art out there, and it's those experiences that I think need to be shared. That's why I do what I do, is to share. It's not about me. It's solely about the artwork and the artists that I create, and being able to create a moment in other people's lives where they can look back and say, you know what, that one piece that I saw that day, it made me want to be more healthy. It made me want to recycle. It made me want to be a better person, or it helped me, like, it exposed me to this culture. And then, like, it's a trickle effect. I think art has that power, not just visual art, but music and dance and the whole art that comes out of culture. It has this effect that nothing else can move you like that.
Because art doesn't stand alone. It doesn't occur in
right.
isolation.
And it's one of those only things that can translate no matter what language you speak, where you're from. It affects you just as much as it'll affect someone on the opposite side of the world.
And where can people go online for more information? Thechattery.org?
Thechattery.org has information. If you want more information about the different other works that I've talked about, KrynTheCurator.com, you'll find the information about the Chattery event, as well as some other artists that I've highlighted, the other artists that I curate and represent. So, or you can just Google the Chattery or Kryn the Curator, and it'll all pop up.
All right. Krynisha, thanks so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
It's that time of year. Sandhill Cranes. The Tennessee Sandhill Crane Festival runs tomorrow and Sunday from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. in Birchwood, celebrating the thousands of sandhill cranes that migrate through or spend the winter on and around the Hiwassee Refuge. Mimi Barnes is with the Tennessee Wildlife Resources Agency, which presents the festival. Mimi, thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
Tell us more about the festival. How long has it been around?
This is actually the 29th year of this festival. What a great thing to celebrate wildlife for 29 years.
And sandhill cranes.
Yes, this festival celebrates the migratory route of the sandhill crane, which we happen to be the ending point for some cranes and a stopover for other cranes. They're all coming down from the Great Lakes region at this time. It's very weather dependent, but all the birds are migrating down from that Great Lakes region up into Canada, and they utilize our refuge as a holdover, a place to eat, a place to stay safe.
And what are they like?
They're over 4 feet tall. Their wingspan is typically around 8 feet tall, and their call can be heard from a mile away. They fly in these huge V formations that a lot of people might see and mistake for Canada geese. But trust me, they sound nothing like a goose. And they're just traveling together in these family units and larger groups for safety. And they come down to the refuge.
And how long have you been keeping an eye on them?
I have been a birder my entire life, thanks to being raised on a farm and having a dad that really enjoyed the outdoors. I always say, thank goodness he did not have a son, because I'm of the generation that a little boy might have been invited outside before me. So I'm delighted to have had a father that invited me outside to see migratory birds. When I was a child, sandhill cranes were not around. You know, this is a species that has made a recovery in the eastern United States. And what a gift that we get to celebrate it now. Because for me, as a child in the 70s, this bird was not around in the numbers that it is today. So I can say I've been watching them for as long as they've been around. It's been at least 20 years for me that I remember seeing my first sandhill crane 20 years ago.
And as those cranes have come back in population, they have shown up on the public consciousness.
They have. More people are aware of them. If you're a wildlife watcher, if you enjoy the outdoors and you're a birder, then you definitely know this bird. A lot of people take pilgrimages to see different birds throughout the United States. Pulaski Refuge is further north and a stopover point as well. And a lot of people visit Pulaski this time of year, but that's quite a drive. You can see them right in your backyard, in a sense, here in Hamilton County with a huge stopover. The high count so far this year has been over 10,000 birds in the area, but we've had as many as 20,000 on the refuge.
Well, tell us more about the festival that celebrates them.
So the festival is Saturday the 18th and Sunday the 19th. It runs 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. and it is free. It's free for families. There's children's activities. There's live music, which is a lot of fun. The American Eagle Foundation joins us for a live raptor show, which is always a highlight. There are free shuttles to our refuge and free shuttles to the Cherokee Removal Memorial. They're a partner with us, and they've partnered for many years with us. So not only are you going to see great birds, you're going to be entertained, and you can visit this historical heritage site.
And there'll be some conversations about the state of the cranes today and what it's going to take to protect them in the future.
Yes, this year we're very fortunate. The International Crane Foundation is joining us. They provide a wealth of information on cranes, as well as Tennessee Wildlife Resources Agency. Our ornithologists will be on hand, of course, and a lot of experts will be on hand to talk to folks. The Tennessee Ornithological Society also joins us. They set up scopes, birding scopes, so people can actually see birds, not just cranes, but other birds close up. Bald eagles, hopefully a golden eagle will show up. That's another migratory species that's here this time of year. And of course, many different types of ducks and other birds too. So a lot of fun.
And you mentioned music. And when we say music, we're talking about music that is reflective of the heritage in which these birds call home.
In some respects, yes. We have a band that joins us called Second Nature. They're out of Nashville and kind of a back porch picking group that does play reflective music. And the LeConte Jug Band is joining us this year. We also have an educational talk. Mary Feely is joining us, and she actually did her graduate work at this university, and she'll be joining us to share her findings.
I think one of these years, the cranes are going to get together and form their own band.
The sound for folks that come to the festival that have never heard this bird before or seen them in mass, the sound is just overwhelming. It's just a sound that's unique. It's unlike any other bird out there. We have folks come from across the country for this festival, and we've even had folks from other countries visit us. So please stop by, say hello to me, tell me where you're from. I love it. It's one of my favorite weekends of the year.
And where can people go online for more information?
TNWildlife.org has all your crane viewing information, not only this time of year. It's not the only weekend the cranes are here. We want you to join us for this lively celebration, but there are other crane viewing opportunities, not just at the Hiawassee Refuge, but throughout the state. The Hiawassee Refuge is unique in the sense that it is a refuge, and it does have a platform, a viewing area that's open year-round for visitors. You're kind of confined to an area for obvious reasons. It's a refuge, and we want to maintain that calmness for the wildlife that's there, including the sandhill cranes this time of year. But it is open, and we have a lot of birders join us, photographers that join us. Great fun.
All right, Mimi, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me here.
In the valley of the Little Tennessee River, near the Appalachian Mountains, sits the 1,200 acres of Fort Loudoun State Historic Park. The British built the fort in the 1750s as they struggled with France and Spain for control of North America, and as the native people of Overhill Cherokee Country strove to protect their homes and their way of life. Tomorrow at the park, starting at 1 p.m., Ranger Lauren Baghetti will talk about the environmental impacts on that landscape from colonial times to modern examples. Lauren, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
How long have you been at Fort Loudoun?
I've been there for almost 4 years.
And what brought you there?
I worked at Norris Dam State Park. It was more of a natural recreational park. And an opening came up at Fort Loudoun, and I thought it was a good time to make a move and work at a historical park and see how it works. I've always had an interest in local history and local culture. Good time to move and good fit.
Tell us more about that local history.
Fort Loudoun was a British fort built during the French and Indian War, and it was there for Cherokee relations. So basically, the Cherokee agreed to fight with the British, but in return, they wanted a fort built to protect Cherokee women and children in case the town should be attacked while the warriors were away fighting. And over the course of the 4 years, relations deteriorated, and they ended up fighting, the British and the Cherokee ended up fighting one another.
This is the backdrop for the talk that you're going to give tomorrow about the Appalachian environment.
Correct. It'll be part of it, yeah. Talk a little bit about how people have impacted and continue to impact the environment and the ecosystem of the Southern Appalachian Mountains. Dating back all the way to the Mississippian period era, people have always impacted the environment, good or bad, and talk about, a little bit highlight about the Southern Appalachian region specifically.
Tell me about some of that impact over various time periods.
Like I said, going back to the Mississippian era, they're known for these great massive earth mounds that they built for ceremonial purposes. You have mounds that are 30 feet in height, and then on top of those, you have a temple that are 30 feet in size. So these are massive mounds, earthen mounds, and that certainly affected the environment, maybe not as greatly as some of the things that have happened in current times. Got a lot of dams in Tennessee in the area, and those have certainly affected the landscape as well as the ecosystems. You've gone from a stream ecosystem to a lake ecosystem, which are different. So talk a little bit about the Mississippian period and even day-to-day living, things that we may not think about how we have affected the environment, but we do. So this example, the colonial fur trades that were happening in early colonial period, there was so much deer hunting going on that it actually impacted the population of the deer. And it not just the deer, but also the food chain going up and down of the food chain, how the hunting of deer affected the food chain. And then also fences. There are different style of fences that people built, and what style of fence they built would use more or less resources than other styles of fences. So even a style of fence that people used affected at least the environment locally, maybe not such on a huge area, region, you know, such as all of the Appalachian Mountains, but a small area, localized. And, you know, certainly I mentioned TVA and how their system of flood control and navigation of rivers have affected the landscape as well.
And then much in between colonial times and the era of TVA to talk about as well.
Yeah, definitely going to talk a little bit about logging, mining. We're all, I think, pretty familiar with coal mining in the area, but there was a lot of iron ore mining. There were salt mines as well. There's a lot of other mining going on as well. So we'll talk a little bit about coal mining, talk a little bit about iron ore mining, certainly logging, and who was in the area. It wasn't just people living here, wasn't the residents here, but also, especially logging, you had foreign investors from England who invested in large tracts of land for their companies. So it's not people who are living here that are impacting the environment, although we certainly are, but you have people who are outside the region that impact the environment as well.
Everybody who's ever lived here has had an impact, either good or bad, and in a lot of cases, good and bad.
Yes, yeah. And that's kind of one I want to hit home is, as human beings, as people, everything we do is going to impact the environment. Like you said, good or bad, just living is going to have an impact on the environment. Some things we can help and some things we can't help, which is how we impact the environment.
So you'll talk about it. How will you show that as part of your talk?
I'll have a few pictures to kind of demonstrate ideas and throw some numbers out. I'm a visual person. I can throw out, you know, however many deer were harvested during the years 1739 to 1761, but you know, I have some numbers to throw up there so you can actually have a visual of how many deer were harvested.
And where can people go online for more information?
You can go to our webpage, Fort Loudoun State Park. It'll be under the Tennessee State Parks. We also have a Facebook page. We're very active on our Facebook page as well.
All right. Lauren, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More after our news with Bill McLean. This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Next week, the Chattanooga Supply Chain Symposium will bring together professionals to network and share ideas on how to build supply chains that are more efficient and effective. The symposium takes place at Kenco Logistics on Wednesday from 8:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. John Fries is director of the Center for Professional Education here on this campus, University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. He stopped by Scenic Roots for a conversation, and joining us by phone, Chris Barnes, a supply chain consultant who will be the symposium's MC. John, Chris, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here, Ray.
Yeah, thank you, Ray.
John, tell us how this first ever Chattanooga Supply Chain Symposium came about.
Sure. The symposium is actually a kickoff to the 2020 Supply Chain Lunch and Learn series. The Lunch and Learn series is something we've been doing for about a year and a half, and we decided that as we were going into 2020, we wanted to do something a little bit bigger to set the tone for the year. And so we decided to go with a half-day event where we were bringing in some high-level folks from companies and organizations here in town to really help us set the tone for the year ahead.
And this is going to be taking place at Kenco.
That's correct.
And one of the guests that you are bringing in is Chris Barnes of Atlanta. Chris, tell us more about your background.
My emphasis is on the supply chain management courses and knowledge that we're trying to develop. I work with John very closely in terms of providing educational opportunities and certification opportunities for people in the supply chain area, specifically within the Chattanooga market. So that's my involvement. Just many years of experience in supply chain. I'm actually going to be the MC of this symposium. So my role is really to hang out with all the other smart people and make sure that everybody is able to tap into their knowledge and their experience.
And of course, supply chains, they have an ever-changing dynamic.
Yeah, so Chattanooga is kind of a unique spot. I know for people local to the area, they probably have heard of Freight Alley, but it's kind of a cluster of very good companies that are providing either startups or long-term companies that are providing logistics services in that space. So it's a very good cluster for the business environment for professionals as well.
And John, the more things change, the more they stay the same when it comes to supply chains running through Chattanooga.
That's right. You know, one of the things that is really driving us to do the symposium is that constant of change. When you look at the supply chain, it is faced with disruption almost daily. And so companies are having to constantly assess, evaluate, and react to some level of disruption. And that's how we came up with the theme of driving innovation, because most companies rely on their innovation talent to take a look at that disruption and say, okay, here's how we can do this different, better, faster, smarter, or more efficiently.
And innovation involves next generation technology.
Absolutely. And we're going to hear some of that next week. We're going to have some folks talking about blockchain next week, which is really, it's really a technology that is really changing the face of how organizations do business. And that's not just in the supply chain, but what we're going to talk about next week is how that is being applied in the trucking industry.
Give us an example.
Well, for example, there's a group here in town called BITA, which stands for Blockchain and Trucking Alliance. And what they're doing is they're actually establishing the blockchain standards that can then be adopted and developed and used by the trucking industry so that they can deploy blockchain uniformly across that industry space.
And when most people first heard of blockchain, it was because of Bitcoin and the buzz around Bitcoin. But I remember story after story at that time saying, pay no attention to that buzz. The type of thing that this technology is really going to be used for is the very thing that you're talking about, John.
Absolutely. I'm by no means an expert in the technology itself, but I will tell you, one of our speakers next week actually wrote an article, I don't know, a month or so ago about, okay, Bitcoin's gone, so what? We're still going to be dealing with blockchain for the foreseeable future.
And Chris, what's your take on all this?
I'm excited. I've been in supply chain typically about 20, 25 years. So I'm more excited now than I was ever in my career. I mean, the whole supply chain is really impacting everybody's life. I tell people that if you don't know what supply chain is, I ask if you've ever bought anything. And the answer is yes, you're the reason for the supply chain. So it's really, it's a great time to be in the industry. There's more jobs available than there are people. There's more opportunity to collaborate. From a technology standpoint, that's very key, especially when you start hearing about supply chain referenced in the everyday media, whether it's due to the tariffs or it's something, it's how Amazon is driving change from a logistics standpoint, or what Alibaba is doing globally. So it's really exciting to be part of that.
Or when it comes to a concern such as climate.
Yeah, well, the climate's a big part of it. It's coming on strong. I mean, we talk about in our certification classes and just general knowledge, we talk about sustainability, corporate social responsibility, things like the triple bottom line, which, you know, it has a lot to do with the carbon footprint and everything else. But there's a lot of things you can do in the supply chain to impact overall general welfare and sustainability.
And John, these are conversations that are also taking place all the time among entrepreneurs and innovators right here in Chattanooga.
That's correct. Yeah, I appreciate you touching on that, Ray. That's something that we wanted these Lunch and Learns to do, is to really help facilitate that conversation so that folks that are in this industry that are dealing with these challenges on a daily basis can come together once a month, network, get to meet other folks that are dealing with the same challenges. And we really wanted to create a community of practitioners, if you will. And that's what really is sort of cool about seeing this happen. And that's what's sort of exciting about the Supply Chain Symposium. It's really starting to catch on.
And where can people go online for more information?
utc.edu/CSCS.
All right. John, thanks so much. And Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you, Ray.
Thank you, Ray.
All the world's a stage, and now Shakespeare has a new champion here in Chattanooga. Scenic City Shakespeare aims to make the works of the Bard accessible to all with theater and educational programs. The group is planning to produce its inaugural season this fall, and it's already hosting monthly discussion groups as part of the Shakespeare 2020 project. Ryan Laskowski is artistic director of Scenic City Shakespeare. He and actor Douglas May dropped by Scenic Roots. Ryan, Doug, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So Ryan, tell us how Scenic City Shakespeare came about.
Well, Emma Wiseman Collins and I met about 12 years ago. And in that time, we've discussed Shakespeare and doing Shakespeare in Tennessee. We've gotten the opportunity to do it together a few times. But we noticed that there was not that much Shakespeare being produced in the city and wanted to try our hand at producing some.
This idea came to you, too, as you were doing a reading?
Well, so that was actually a dinner party that we had where I had adapted Pyramus and Thisbe, the most lamentable comedy, sort of a play within a play from Midsummer Night's Dream. We ate dinner and read that scene, so there were 10 of us there. The idea was already sort of in existence. I knew that I was wanting to start a company, but I wanted to make sure that I actually had a good idea. So I brought in some people that I know and I trust in the theater community and said, hey guys, will you do this reading with me?
It's sort of a trial balloon with food.
Yes, lots and lots of
food. Your literary focus group, but well fed.
Right. Well, every show is better if it's preceded with really good food.
I have to have a meal before I go on stage.
So we have Scenic City Shakespeare.
Yes, and you have to say it exactly like that, or it's dangerous. In addition to, we want to produce a regular season of shows. We also have a puppet playhouse in the works right now. We've just started puppet construction. We also have the Shakespeare 2020 project.
The Shakespeare 2020 project is, I believe, we're part of a larger nationwide project.
Really, and international.
Ryan has had contact with the man who initiated the project. Ryan, why don't you tell him about it?
Ian Dosher, he's an author. He wrote several, I guess, adaptations, you could call them Shakespearean adaptations of films. So there's William Shakespeare's Star Wars, Much Ado About Mean Girls, and Get Thee Back to the Future, which is my favorite, personally.
They're very entertaining.
They are. They're great. But he wanted to challenge himself to read the complete works in 2020 and decided he would open that up to everybody. Started a Facebook group. That group has grown to over 3,000 people. There are people across the world doing this now. And that Facebook group has actually turned into a pretty good resource for memes and weird historical tidbits and that sort of thing. It's really a great group. So we wanted to have a local version. So I reached out to him, said, hey, would you mind if I sort of tagged onto this? He said, yeah, that's great. That's exactly what I want. So here we are.
And you'll be participating each month. And the first one will be this coming Monday.
Right. We'll be at the Edney building. We'll start about 7 o'clock and we'll be discussing the first two, you could say, but really the first four. It's Twelfth Night and then Henry VI, part one, two, and three. We're currently in Henry VI, part one. He's developed a whole schedule for the entire year. So it goes up to December 30th with Winter's Tale, or the funeral elegy is the last one.
And they are arranged in an optimal fashion so that, let's just say, you don't get stuck in the problem plays. And a number of them are geared towards the time of the year in which the original story is set.
Right.
For instance, Twelfth Night, we just had Twelfth Night.
Yes, January 6th is the official Twelfth Night, the actual holiday Twelfth Night. So we were reading that on the 6th, and then we moved into Henry. So most of the schedule he ties in, so like Midsummer Night's Dream happens during midsummer. But then other than that, they are chronologically as they were written by Shakespeare. And there have been some arguments in that Facebook group about whether or not his schedule is correct. But
Shakespeare wouldn't be Shakespeare without arguments, right?
Amen.
And without
especially
mystery.
Especially in Henry. Yeah.
That's right. So we have the Shakespeare 2020 project. You mentioned the Puppet Playhouse in the works. What else are you thinking of there at Scenic City Shakespeare?
Well, we plan to launch a season. We're in talks with a few different venues.
We can't say in detail about that. We are negotiating with venues to have a regular production and also a Shakespeare event with food, because everything's better with food.
That's right.
So we want to try to make Shakespeare a little bit more accessible. A lot of people, they start in and they see what they actually have to process and it doesn't seem comfortable to them. So we're trying to figure out ways to make it a little bit more modern adaptations of Shakespeare when we can.
I think that there are people who have an interest in Shakespeare, but they feel an intimidation because they feel put off by the language, which I think has become more of a problem now, especially as we have moved away from most mainstream religions don't use the King James Version of the Bible anymore. And I think that that kept the language culturally current for many, many years in our nation. And we're losing that. I think that people have interest, but to take in a written work originally designed for the stage is much different than, say, taking in a painting, even though the rewards can stay with you for just as long a time.
And as far as making it more accessible for an audience here in Chattanooga and the Tennessee Valley, both of you have such experience. I was just reading up on yours with Ensemble Theater, and Doug, you've been a guest here on Scenic Roots before. Part of this is about knowing your audience, and you folks know your audience.
We hope we do. I think another really important thing to get an audience member to connect with a piece, especially one that's in almost a completely different language, is to really get them to connect with the characters.
These stories are the stories of our culture, and they still have currency. I mean, obviously, Lion King, which is basically Hamlet, has been running on Broadway for, what, 20 years now? And there was a remake in the theaters last year. We respond to these stories because they tell truthful things about the way that we act with each other as people. And I think that can be easy to forget because the language sounds different from the way that we speak now.
Where can people go online for more information as it unfolds?
Well, so for more information about us, you can go to our website, sceniccityshakespeare.org, sceniccityshakespeare.org. If you want to get the schedule for the Shakespeare 2020 project, you can go over to Ian Dosher's website. That's shakespeare2020.com. He also has his own website, iandosher.com. It looks like iandoesshare.com.
Share the singer.
Yes. I don't think that he does that.
And we also have a handy dandy Facebook page of our own.
Yes, you can look us up on Facebook and also Instagram at Scenic City Shakespeare.
All right. Ryan, Doug, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Color Chattanooga Pink starts tomorrow, a week of events that lead up to next Saturday's Pink Gala, which raises funds for the Mary Ellen Locher Breast Center at CHI Memorial. Mark Height is co-chair of Color Chattanooga Pink, and Dr. Betsy Washburn is a breast oncology surgeon at the Locher Breast Center. Mark, Betsy, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me more about Color Chattanooga Pink.
Well, the event, Pink, which is truly the largest fundraiser in our community, has been around for 14 years. However, Color Chattanooga Pink is only in its third year, and we're just getting our speed up this year because what takes place is Pink is a huge fundraiser. It's been sold out for some time, 1,250 people at an amazing event at the convention center that raises hundreds of thousands of dollars. However, our challenge is how do we step outside the convention center and talk to hundreds of thousands of people about the importance of early detection and awareness of the opportunities that 1 in 8 women will be affected by breast cancer in their lifetime. And so the way we make inroads into this is early detection. So that's why we're appreciative of you having us here today to talk about the importance of coloring Chattanooga Pink so that we can get to more people in our community.
And Color Chattanooga Pink provides multiple opportunities to have that conversation.
It absolutely does. And that's why we're relying on your listeners today to simply hashtag Color Chattanooga Pink. We have specific events running the week of the 19th through the 25th of January. We've got restaurant give back nights. We've got all kinds of our sponsors that are hosting events going on during that week. But the most important thing that your listeners can do is to get together with some friends, get together themselves, and on social media, take pictures, talk about, and always tag hashtag Color Chattanooga Pink, because that will allow us to have hundreds of thousands of people talking about early detection of breast cancer. And every person listening today can do their part, and we need each person to do their part.
And Betsy, tell us more about your work and how Pink, and now Color Chattanooga Pink, plays such a pivotal role in the community.
Just like Mark said, you know, we've had the Pink Gala for quite some time that has raised hundreds of thousands of dollars to fund back into treating this community's breast cancer. And that's amazing. But he's right. We really need it to not be a stigma. We need women to talk about it and to know about it and to really embrace the idea that this is a treatable disease. So at the Breast Center, we rely heavily on the population knowing about Mary Ellen Locher Breast Center, that what we offer to the population, but also that giving back to this is how we can treat other people.
What are some things that women might not know?
I think the biggest thing is women think breast cancer's a death sentence. Breast cancer is really treatable when caught early, and catching it early has become really easy. We've gotten better at imaging. We've gotten better at young women, which is more common for young women to get breast cancer these days, to image a young woman's breast better, and we're catching things early. So if we catch it early, we can treat it, and I think that's the most important thing.
There's always more to be done, but things have come a long way in this area.
Absolutely. The 3D mammogram is huge. We offer it in almost all of our Mary Ellen Locher Breast Centers now, and it is a way to look at dense breast tissue and find very small changes year to year that we couldn't see with a two-dimensional routine mammogram. So, and that was bought with Pink dollars. Our 3D mammogram machines were all bought with Pink dollars.
What are some of the challenges ahead when it comes to diagnosing, treating breast cancer, making sure that women get that early detection, regardless of where they live or the rest of their background?
I think in our community, a lot of women live further away. And so a lot of people think, well, that's just a drag. I don't have to go to this big hospital to go get my mammogram. One of the things we're funding with Pink this year is a new mobile coach. Our oldest mobile coach, which was bought with Pink dollars, is 14, 15 years old now. And that coach goes out into the communities that aren't close to an imaging center, and we do mammograms on it. So we've actually been able to pick up cancers in women much further out than we would normally reach.
How far?
Gosh, I mean, I know we go into well past North Georgia, you know, to get Lafayette. There are a lot of people in Lafayette that get imaging. We go to a lot of factories where women can't get off of work to get their mammogram, and there are bosses will let them take their lunch break and get their mammogram in the parking lot, and are one of our mobile coaches. So it really helps a lot of women that otherwise wouldn't have that opportunity.
And then tell us about each of the events that are taking place during the week.
If you just start, get on social media and go to Pink Gala, would be an easy place for you to get the full list of our participating vendors and shops. Literally, there are hundreds of things going on during the week. We have a variety of salons that are coloring their salons pink. We have restaurants that have special drinks, special menus, and specific give back nights. One of the biggest events, though, will be on the 22nd, which is at the Unum main campus in downtown Chattanooga from 11 to 1. We have kind of a kickoff of the week. It'll highlight with proclamations from the mayors. We've got food trucks set up. It'll be a great gathering point for those downtown to talk about and raise awareness.
Where can people go online for more information?
Two easy spots to go. One is just to go onto Facebook and type in Pink Gala, or you can go to memorial.org/pink, and you'll find a full list of all the vendors, the restaurants, the shops, and activities going on throughout the week of the 19th through the 25th.
All right, Mark, Betsy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. Our show is produced by Haley Solomon, Carly Dodson, and Will Davis from the studios of WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Follow us on Twitter at scenicroots423 and email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Also, follow WUTC on Facebook and Instagram, and listen online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. Have a good weekend, and join us again next time for Scenic Roots.